here on a Friday to celebrate it. Glad you're enjoying us.
Thank you so much for being aboard. As you know, it's time for American Hit Radio on 90.3 WHPC. I'm Tom Ryan, my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales Ryan, here as well. And today we are going to present, rather incredibly, part 35 in our seemingly never-ending series on The Who. Getting very, very deep. And we are at a crucial part of the story here as we are covering the album, Who Are You?, which was released in August of 1978. An album that basically, again, stopped at the top of the charts, peaked at number 2 in the U.S., number 6 in the U.K. That's as far as it could get. Now, we covered a great deal of the album last week, maybe about half of it. Now, we're going to cover the rest as we can, as much as we can, with today's show. I think we'll be able to finish it up and then some. So I want to talk about Pete a little bit. Well, let Pete talk about himself, I should say, taking an excerpt from his autobiography, Who I Am, about the sessions. Now, last week, we played some of his demos, and here's what he said he spent a full year on. Neary writes, after the wonder of the demos, recording the Who Are You album was no fun. I was really proud of my new songs, but Roger felt that some were overproduced. He didn't fight me over this, but he did punch Glyn Johns on the nose.
Oh, no.
And my brother-in-law, John Astley, had to take over. John loved my work of the time and was very encouraging. At one session, Keith labored over a jazzy 6/8 swing, but when I offered to drop the song from the record, Keith suddenly came alive. You can hear some of Keith struggling with the arrangements as his drumming is either absent or not nearly as relevant as it had been on previous Who records. The first two tracks that I want to play today really will make that point rather strongly. First up is the track Sister Disco from the album. Just notice how Keith's presence just seems almost ghostly compared to what you normally expect on a Who record. Here is the track Sister Disco on 90.3 WHPC.
As I walk through that hospital door, I was sewn up like a cub. I got a smile from the bite of the wind. Watch the fresh fall of snow. Street fire has its own.
Sister Disco, a track that is odd. I think a lot of the songs on this album strike me as odd because it seems like it is Pete for the first time being reactionary to the music industry rather than trying to lead it. He seems to be wondering, you know, how he can follow what a certain path. And
where is he going to next?
Right. And punk rock has got him maybe feeling very derailed because of it. And so he's got management that's trying to lead him down this corridor toward corporate rock because, after all, they're a big band. You want to make sure you get played on American radio. So you've got to play what American radio is demanding, American rock radio was demanding at the time, which was also becoming a bit of a dinosaur in itself. American rock radio would be disappearing within 10 years' time. But contemporary it was very important that they kept up. The sad thing is, though, that by following corporate demands, The Who almost overnight changed from being punk's primary inspiration to becoming a parody of themselves.
Irony.
Really ironic, right? Now, this is an excerpt now being taken from Richard Barnes' book called Maximum R&B. Keith, John, and Pete were all drinking very heavily during the sessions, not just the usual Who tipple of cognac. They'd also developed a taste for vintage port. At about 6 o'clock, the port would come out. They'd all start sitting around talking about the old days and telling jokes until it was time to go home. Glyn Johns would often get really bored with the lack of progress and leave. The drinking affected Keith very heavily. He'd be drinking as soon as he arrived at the studios and carry on throughout the sessions. His drumming was very erratic. He'd be good for about 10 minutes, then he'd go off the boil. Then he'd be hopeless for an hour or so. Then he'd be good again for a bit more and then lose it again. Keith was normally incredibly consistent and easily had enough stamina to keep up a powerful rhythm throughout a long number, but he seemed to have lost it. He was flagging and losing count. They did take after take and were not getting very far. Although the drink and drugs affected his playing, living in L.A. hadn't helped him either. He'd been California dreaming for 2 years.
Mm-mm-mm.
He'd put on a lot of weight, and his sheer physical size slowed him down. One evening, they went for a meal in a restaurant around the corner from the recording studio. The group had been putting pressure on Keith, and on this night, Pete had a talk with him alone. He told him that if he didn't pull himself together, he would be out of the group. This talk, accompanied by pressure from the others, had the desired effect. They moved back to Ramport, and Keith did practically the entire drumming on the album in 10 days. Usually the drums are the first thing to be recorded, but in this case, they were mostly added at the last minute. Pete already had a simple guide track on his demos. Keith had the added task now of playing to tracks that were already down. One of the numbers that they were recording, called Choir Boy, wasn't working out. Pete said that he'd get another demo together over the weekend, and then he came in on Monday with a 24-track demo of a song called Music Must Change. This time, Keith couldn't handle the drumming required for this track. He was coming out of his good spell, and anyway, it was in 6-8 time, and Keith always had trouble with 6-8, so he didn't really try very hard, remembers Astley. The recording op, it was Pete's brother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
Pete took the track back to Goring and recorded his footsteps for percussion. The percussion on that track is Pete's footsteps, and on a good stereo, you can hear his squeaky shoes as he paces around the floor. We added the sound of a milk bottle falling down some steps, too, as though he'd kicked it. Here, then, is the track that gave poor Keith so much trouble. The drumless track, as it appeared on the album of Music Must Change on 90.3 WHPC.
Says it soon could be found. When I hear the cold lies of the pusher, I know it exists. It's confirmed in the eyes of the kids, emphasized with their fists. But the high has to rise from the low, like
Volcanoes explode through the snow. The mosquito sting brings a dream, but the poison's deranged. The music must change, for we're chewing a bone. We soared like the sparrowhawk fly, then we dropped like a stone. Like the tide and the waves, growing slowly in range. Crushing mountains as old as the earth, so the music must change. Sometimes at night I wake up and my body's like ice. The sound of the running wild stallion, the noise of the mice. And I wondered if then I could hear into all of your dreams. I realize now it was really the sound of your screams. But death always leads on to life. The street fighter swallows the knife. Am I so crazy to feel that it's here prearranged? The music must change. It gets higher and higher. Smoldering like leaves in the sun, then it bursts into fire. Its rhythm goes strong. It's so new and so strange. Is this song so different? Am I doing it all again? It may have been done before, but the music's an open door. My mind is an unrealized sound. Every feeling I get from the street says it soon could be found. When I hear the cold lies of the pusher, I know it exists. It's confirmed in the eyes of the kids, emphasized with their fists. But the high has to rise from the low. Like volcanoes explode through the snow. The mosquito sting brings a dream, but the poison's deranged. That music must change, or we're chewing a bone. We saw it like a sparrowhawk fly, then we drop like a stone. Like the tide and the waves, growing slowly in range. Crushing
it is. Imagine, there's very few Who songs that don't have drumming, and the ones that don't are usually acoustic numbers, so that's a strange thing.
That was a strange animal.
To have that without anything on it at all. Keith wasn't the only one who was nuts, though. The band had hired a keyboardist for recording the new album, somebody who would stick with Pete for a lot of his solo albums as well, as the, you know, time wore on. And his name was Rabbit John, well, John Bundrick. They called him Rabbit. And this is Pete talking here. He was true to his name, a fast keys player in my book. He brought tricky new songs like Music Must Change and Sister Disco to life and allowed us to avoid the use of stage tapes. His Hammond and piano solos were often mind-blowing. Yet, however badly Rabbit behaved, Keith was still my main concern. At these rehearsals, which we filmed, he was hilarious as ever, but I spent a lot of time attempting to get him in line. One evening, Keith invited Rabbit and me to a small gathering at Keith Richards' house in Chelsea. Mick was there, with Corinthia West, an old friend of mine that I'd met with Mike and Katie McInerney. She was tall and beautiful, the only female there. While Mick and Keith were playing old R&B records and I was bantering with Eric Idle and Amit Erdogan, quite a get-together, Rabbit decided that he'd never be an important enough rock star to attract women like Corinthia, so he tried to drown himself in a bathtub full of water. Then, when that failed, he leapt from a second-floor window like a gin and ran down the street with no shirt.
Nice.
What a bunch of lunatics. Musically, though, Keith's drumming was getting so uneven that the recording was almost impossible, so much so that the work on the Who Are You album had ground to a halt. Keith even went public with the fact that the recording had been prematurely interrupted by his condition. We had just about enough tracks for a record with very little additional music to spare. Music Must Change, for that reason, was completed with Footsteps replacing the drums, because they needed the song on the album. Now, on the album Who Are You, there are three John Entwistle tracks on it. He submitted seven demos. The rest of the album is by Pete, and what is surprising is that given the time that the album was released, it makes absolutely no concessions whatever to punk rock, heavy metal, or disco music at all. This is especially strange given Pete's involvement and encouragement of young British punk groups. Quite the reverse. Although Pete's lyrics are very concerned with musical changes, the album heads off once again in a completely new direction when Pete's songs come up. That is why I feel that it's sometimes a bit of a relief when the John Entwistle tracks come up on this album. They lighten things up a bit. We played two last week. Here is the third John Entwistle album from Who Are You called
Song.
Trick. I'm sorry?
John Entwistle's Song.
Songs, thank you. From the album Who Are You, here's Trick of the Light on 90.3 WHPC.
Ceiling feeling.
It's funny because there are a few people in the world who I think are a bigger fan of Pete Townsend than I am. But I remember distinctly in when this album came out in history, in my own opinion, I was kind of jarred by this record, and I didn't really understand where Pete was going. I felt that it was John Entwistle who was keeping The Who alive at this point in time.
It seems like it.
Right? Because his songs were certainly stronger.
Yes.
I thought that Roger was over singing, and I thought that Pete basically had his head up his butt with the way that he was writing songs, just being way too self-analytical. And in the age of punk rock, I mean, the Who energy just seemed to be dissipating. And even the album cover.
Because they were, to so many punks, they were heroes, the earlier stuff.
Right. Exactly. And it just felt as if they were like, you know, basically, they were basically setting themselves up for irrelevance almost. It was weird. Even the album cover, the album sleeve is one of the dullest album covers ever. Apparently, the record company was screaming for the album, so they had to just shoot anything. Now, many people find significance in the fact that Keith is sitting in a chair marked not to be taken away on the cover. The fact is simple, though. He was originally standing up, but they sat him there with the back of the chair facing the camera to try to hide his large stomach. It was just necessary. Now, there's one song on the album that Pete wrote that had nothing to do with the music industry or the people in the music industry or writing songs or disco or how music must change or you need a new song. This is one of the few that basically falls outside of that category. It's called Love Is Coming Down on 90.3 WHPC.
Surrounded by people, a real heavy crowd. But inside I still feel lonely now. Should I get away from the high heel so proud? Is there something different life can show me?
It's almost enough to make you feel sorry for Pete around this point in time. There's so much that seems to be coming like to a head with his personality and with what he's feeling that's coming out on this album. And with Keith not connecting and Pete having trouble connecting, the band seemed like they were like out of time all of a sudden. It was very odd. The title track did offer a significant amount of an edge and some focus, though. If you'll notice, there are two distinctly different verses in the song. The first verse is all about a night that he went out drinking with the Sex Pistols and started ranting about the music business and how ridiculous it was. And basically was saying, like, I'm done with it. You know, you take over. You know, who are you? Basically is what he's saying to them. You know, you may as well do it, you know, because I've already done it. We all know who I am. Why don't you show me, you know, who are you? And it was a lot of interesting attitude in that first verse. But what's it, you know, he only went that far when he wrote the song. And then Pete had taken a vacation as he was still a big, you know, follower of Meher Baba. And I think it was in Florida where there was sort of like a Meher Baba resort area, a very, you know, very beautiful grounds and a lake and everything. And Pete was walking around there and he basically felt the presence of Meher Baba. And then it was in that frame of mind where he wrote the second verse of the song about how could he measure up to such a love as this. That was him basically reflecting on how he was incapable of meeting what Meher Baba stood for. It's a very contradictory song in that regard with two distinctly different verses. Here it is, the title track, Who Are You, on 90.3 WHPC. So ends the album from August, released in August of 1978. The Who Are You?
The Who Am I? Who Am I?
Eighth studio album. Now, as this was going down, while the band is recording this album, this is incredible. They actually put up the money for Jeff Stein, a 19-year-old New York kid and a total Who fanatic, to complete a film history of the group. A rather strange decision, although typical of the Who, to want a true fan to have some control over a documentary film on themselves rather than a professional documentary filmmaker who wouldn't have had the passion and fervor of a New York fan to let someone so young and inexperienced be the director. Believe it or not, 19 years old. 19.
Where's he now?
Undeterred, Jeff set about tracking down rare footage for the Who film and video. He had none previous experience in filmmaking.
Not even college?
None.
Wow.
Yet he convinced the band to support the project and let him serve as the film's director. The only thing that he had done before was he made...
They must have really been drunk.
He put together, right? Well, here's the story. He had put together a book of photographs from the band's 1971 tour when he was 17. So he approaches Townsend with this idea about a movie made up of live clips, and Townsend rejected the idea. But it was their manager, Bill Kerbishley, who said, maybe give the kid a chance. You know, let's try this. So he was also suggested that, you know, basically what Jeff Stein said to Pete Townsend when he was, got him to reconsider it, was he said to him that maybe you could let the film do the touring for the band. And for Townsend, that seemed like a fantastic idea because obviously he was having doubts.
The light bulb went off.
Yeah, it was like he was really having doubts about touring, right? So he goes, you're right, maybe we don't have to do it. So Stein puts together, he goes through trash bins, literally.
Oh, my goodness.
And he goes like Sweden, Germany, Australia, France, Norway, Finland, putting together every single possible clip that he can find. He's relentless. He's really working it. And he comes up and he puts together a 17-minute compilation of clips from the band's television appearances in the United States. And he got the band and their wives together to view it to see if they would continue to go ahead with the project.
Interesting.
So this is what happens by an eyewitness. Townsend was on the floor screaming, banging his head. He and Moon were hysterical. Daltrey's wife was laughing so hard that she knocked over the coffee table in the screening room.
Oh, my goodness.
Their reaction was unbelievable. They loved it, and that's when they were convinced that the movie really was worth doing. So Stein continued on to put this whole thing together. They realized, though, that there was a big gap in what they were able to get, because around the time that the Who were playing Baba O'Reilly and Won't Get Fooled Again live, they weren't doing any television appearances, so there really was no good footage of those songs. So it was decided that they would get together in front of an invited audience to play contemporary versions of those songs to end the film. So they went to Shepperton Studios on May 25, 1978, to record those two tracks. Now, I don't care if you're a Who fan, if you're not a Who fan, you've got to see the movie Kids Are All Right. It is a fabulous, fabulous documentary. I think one of the best rock and roll documentaries ever made. It's incredibly entertaining. I understand why the band and their wives were falling on the floor laughing and kicking over tables. It's just hysterical the way it captures the spirit of the band. The one thing about it that is flagging, and unfortunately it's where we have to go right now, is what was happening in May of 1978. Keith and his ability to play seemed to be like virtually vanishing. It was like dissipating into thin air. And here they are now at Shepperton Studios playing the songs that on the studio versions are some of the most brilliant drumming that Keith ever did. And now we have Keith, overweight, distracted, incapable of playing at even one-tenth of the... You know, we always talk about snap, Heidi, that incredible snap. But Keith would play ahead of the beat. He was so relentless and anxious the way that he played. Well, here, you hear the exact opposite. You hear the backing tapes that he's playing along with, and he's got his headphones on, but he's just not getting it done. And you can hear how he's dragging. Here's one of those songs from the Shepperton takes. This is the version of Won't Get Fooled Again. I do advise you pay as close attention as you can to Keith Moon's drumming on this track.
Thank you.
All right. Now there, that's before Keith's energy started to wane completely. But again, this is from Keith's, there I go again, Pete's autobiography. Jeff Stein's film on The Who was nearly completed and he wanted a live Who show for The Kids Are All Right. He put me under relentless pressure. I was terrified that Keith wouldn't be able to hide his deteriorating condition on stage, but agreed to it. The show, a short one at Kilburn State Cinema, was appalling. We were all out of practice. Keith was hard to drive along, and I became very angry very quickly. It wasn't Keith's fault. He was half dead from alcohol-related exhaustion and sedatives. There was some affectionate heckling from the punks in the audience, and I responded with a tirade. I was assuming that the audience was full of punks hoping we'd fall, and in my view of the day, that's precisely what happened. So after that abysmal performance, Jeff Stein persuaded us to do a second shoot that would be better produced, more expensively shot, and we'd only be expected to play a few selected songs before an invited audience of Who fans. The shoot was set up in the largest stage on Shepparton. Keith was in a good mood, but bloated and unfit, and he found the repeated takes wearying, whereas the rest of us had the adrenaline to keep going. His earphones kept falling off, so we ended up with them taped to his head with black gaffer's tape. In the movie, this is actually a movie that Keith Moon would never get to see, and this is a recording of the very last live performance of Keith's life. Again, you can listen and you might hear the difference. This is the track Baba O'Reilly, which closes the film Kids Are All Right. Thanks so much for listening, folks. We'll be back next week with the continuation of our story on The Who.